It's time for Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 3 years has shared with us her decades' research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative and judicial processes in America. And now, here's Mae.
Good afternoon. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. Monday, November the 18th, 1974. And this is Dialogue Conspiracy number 171. This week we are adding to the broadcast station WVUD in Dayton, Ohio. Welcome to Dialogue Conspiracy. We've missed 3.5 years, but any day that you take on the program and begin from there and build up a listening audience, you will get into the swing of things, the format of the show, and join us and follow my line of reasoning and research, and hopefully we'll be able to spread some information to you back there in Ohio that we've been sharing out here in California and other stations around the country. The format of the show, I should explain, has always been to take the news of the week from the time one show has ended until the following week and show how that news pertains to the past political assassinations and conspiracies, because in the news every week is some information about the murder of John Kennedy, new information coming out on that conspiracy, or Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, or Malcolm X, and many other political assassinations that have been taking place. I call those the majors and the main assassinations, and then there have been others that have been going along at the same time, that people that have been killed by the same persons that killed these parties. But the important thing, these were the electoral assassinations. That includes the attempted murder of George Wallace in 1972 in the shopping center in Laurel, Maryland. The shooting of Wallace, he didn't die, but the same people shot at him that killed Robert Kennedy or Martin Luther King or John Kennedy. And the evidence of these conspiracies keeps appearing, as I say, every week in the news. I was doing this show for 2 years before the Watergate story broke and recognized the men, the team that was arrested at the hotel, as being part of the CIA that has altered the electoral process through what I call either bullets or blackmail for the past years, ever since John Kennedy won the election in 1960. So I proceeded to link the Watergate, what is known now from Dallas to Watergate, was a connection I made in June 1972. And then when the SLA took place, and it have surfaced last year, just a year ago, last November was when Dr. Foster was killed in Oakland, and then Patricia Hearst was kidnapped in January. I realized that this was probably the last big brouhaha of the Central Intelligence Agency, if they could swing this thing off of violence or terrorism, kidnapping in America, we would have the excuse for a police state, and the police agencies would take over. If we can break each individual kidnapping or bombing threat and show how they are related to the intelligence agencies, they may have to back down. When I say intelligence agencies, I refer to the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, and the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency. My background in this research began just 11 years ago this week. This is an anniversary, the anniversary of John Kennedy's death. It was 11 years ago this week. I began collecting newspapers about that assassination, and in September 64, the Warren Report was published. That is the document that was a summary of the killing of President John Kennedy and Lee Harvey Oswald and Officer J.D. Tippit in Dallas, Texas. In December 64, I bought the 26 volumes of the President's Commission on the Assassination of John Kennedy, and I read those for 8 years and cross-filed them before I went public, so to speak, and did any writing or speaking on the radio. I finished that research and cross-filed these 26 volumes. That's almost 26,000 pages. And in breaking down the Warren Report, I realized that you had the formation of every intelligence operation, the format of the way they worked, the modus operandi, and worse than the assassination was the cover-up that includes the Justice Department, the Supreme Court, the Attorney General, on down the line to the local police departments. And after doing that extensive work, with the John Kennedy assassination and simultaneously working on the other murders that were taking place. They all fit the same format and the same pattern. And it's a dead ring formula. It's a fail-safe. You can figure out these conspiracies because every one of the government conspiracies uses the same method of operation. The Warren Commission was made up of Earl Warren, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Alan Dulles, former head of the CIA, Hale Boggs from Louisiana, a close friend of Lyndon Johnson's, and Mr. Russell from Georgia, Senator Russell, who's now dead. He was the watchdog for the CIA in Congress. And Mr. Cooper, John Cooper, who's now ambassador to East Germany, and John J. McCloy, the oil lawyer conduit of CIA agents from his law office affiliated with the Central Intelligence Agency. It was a CIA Defense Intelligence Agency conspiracy, and the CIA and the DIA were represented on the Warren Commission. In the 11 years since John Kennedy was murdered, there's approximately 109 books, critical books, on the John Kennedy assassination. I studied autopsy, photographic documents, the autopsy records that were available, and began to increase my newspaper reading to 8 papers a day, and many magazine articles that come in and take the evidence of the, not only the John Kennedy assassination, as I say, but the others, and have fit them to one formula and one plan. An example of what I say the news of the week, the Zodiac News Service had a story this week on James Earl Ray. We've been talking about him in the last few weeks on the program here, Dialogue Conspiracy, because he had a hearing in Memphis, Tennessee, for reasons to have a new trial. He said that he did not kill Martin Luther King, and he's asked for a new trial. That decision of whether he can have a new trial will be given in about 2 weeks. The judge will give that decision based upon all the evidence that was presented the last 3 weeks. But the news service this week, Zodiac News Service, had a story that the lawyer for James Earl Ray is in contact with an intermediary who is reaching, who knows the actual assassins of Dr. Martin Luther King. There are two men that have said that they had assassinated Martin Luther King, and the attorney, Robert Livingston, the attorney for James Ray, is also in touch with the intermediary of these two men. And what they're bargaining for now is immunity, and they're going to name 4 prominent, wealthy Americans who hired them to kill Martin Luther King. I've been talking about this conspiracy since 1968, right from the time that Martin Luther King was murdered. So the evolving of the evidence up to the point where the known assassins are in contact with James Ray's lawyer has been surfacing and working itself out. And I think that one reason these men are speaking is not only were they deprived of the $250,000 that they were offered by these backers, but there are many researchers like myself, hundreds of them around the country, and lawyers working on this, and investigators, that the field of investigation into the political assassinations has developed so highly that it's just a matter of time until the true story of the 60s and 70s unfolds. I'm not pessimistic that this story isn't going to unfold, and when the actual assassins step forward for immunity, then one conspiracy will open up another, and maybe the gentleman who shot Robert Kennedy, allegedly, the story goes, it's Thane Caesar, a security guard from Lockheed in California who was behind Robert Kennedy. Maybe he'll surface and want immunity if he tells the story, and then the truth will be told that Sirhan didn't kill Robert Kennedy. And all of the researchers who have spent 2 to 4 to 6 years on the John Kennedy know that Lee Harvey Oswald did not kill John Kennedy. He didn't even own a rifle or know that there was a rifle in the building that would be planted against him the day that John Kennedy was murdered. I have the outline of a book. I want to do a book on Lee Harvey Oswald and the fact that he didn't even know about the rifle. So this kind of news service about James Ray and the attorney are the things that we go into on Dialogue Conspiracy. As I say, there's been 11 years now since John Kennedy was murdered. The very first article, long article, on the conspiracy to murder John Kennedy came out in Ramparts Magazine, November 1966. I helped write that article with David Welsh. He came down from San Francisco to my home in Carmel. The center part of the article, a great deal of it was done by Penn Jones from Texas, on the various people that had been murdered that were related to the political assassination of John Kennedy. But that article mentioned a group of sleuths. The researchers in those days, that was in 66, referred to as the sleuths. And there were 11 of them, and then I deleted my name from that article, even though I helped write it and had been very active researching it already for 3 years, 2 years. I didn't want it, my name included until I had gone through the 26 volumes and had enough evidence or conclusions set down of what I was saying before I surfaced, because it would be easy to detract from the researchers before they completed their work. And I felt 64 to 66 wasn't enough time to cross-file all these volumes and to come out and with a positive statement until I went through all the volumes and then come to my own conclusion. So I waited 8 years before I really surfaced with what I believe was evidence that Oswald not only didn't kill John Kennedy, but he never had a rifle or saw the rifle. The sleuths that began working in 1963, 11 years ago, November 22nd or 24th, 1963, one of them was Sylvia Mayer, who was working in the United Nations building. I believe she still is. She wrote a book, Accessories After the Fact. Another one was Maggie Fields, a housewife in Beverly Hills, and Penn Jones from Texas, Midlothian, Texas, a publisher. And Ray Marcus was living in Los Angeles, a salesman, and David Lifton was an engineering student at UCLA, getting a master's degree. Harold Weisberg was formerly at the FBI, living in Maryland. Mark Lane, the well-known attorney from New York, was a member of the New York Assembly. And Joachim Joosten came out from Germany to Dallas because he recognized a pattern of operation that he saw when Hitler came to power. He wrote the first book called Oswald, Assassin or Fall Guy. And Thomas Buchanan surfaced. He wrote a book, Who Killed Kennedy? And he lives in Paris. Paul Hawk, the physicist, began his research. Vincent Salandria, an attorney in Pennsylvania, and Harold Feldman began to do investigation on the shots. So there were 11 of us in the country that began our research seriously either November 22nd when Kennedy was shot. I began mine 2 days later when Oswald shot Jack Ruby in the Dallas Police Department. I have a lot of mixed emotions about this 11th anniversary. The years go fast. I'm glad I'm doing the work I did. I've spent a lot of time, sometimes 14, 16 hours a day, some work almost every day. I don't regret for a minute that I've done it. It's been interesting work. I've met interesting people. I feel that I've put my hands into something very important to understand our times, to understand genocide or the food shortage or the Middle East war that's coming up, the manipulation of the oil people that were on the Warren Commission report, that you can study the past and put it historically into a certain context. You can predict the future and you understand the present. And that's worth all the effort, I feel, to be in tune or in rhythm with the news that's coming and the events that come, that in a way maybe I can help shape them. I hopefully can rewrite the history. I have the outline, if I have the time, of rewriting the history of the 60s and 70s based upon what I consider documentation rather than propaganda. Propaganda is what brought Adolf Hitler to power. Propaganda is what the fascist state needs. Propaganda is based on lies. And on the other side of the coin is truth. And the history of man is a struggle, whether it's the Romans against Jesus that they're putting up on the cross, the struggle of truth and propaganda. These two forces are always opposing each other. And it's a constant battle. It isn't anything that's settled with one issue. The schools in Carmel, California, are very good. My children have been educated here. We consider them fairly well informed, but propaganda comes through their little minds just like everywhere else in the country. I have a brochure my daughter brought home from social studies class. The class got it this week. They were, I would say it's fairly Republican area. As a matter of fact, Bert Talcott just won, one of the few Republicans that held in this last election. Fairly conservative Republican town and not great Kennedy lovers for the most part. But the school system was remembering John Kennedy's death. I thought that was rather touching, the social studies class. And my daughter brought home a four-page study booklet, Social Studies, John F. Kennedy, and a picture of Kennedy. And you think, well, that's nice to remember him on the 11th anniversary of his death. And then I read the text, and this is the way it begins. This is the propaganda that a 12-year-old educated child gets in a fairly good school system all over the world, and my child brings this home. It says, the man looked out the window down on the pavement, and people were beginning to crowd the curb. The man gave a little smile. Soon, he thought, in a few minutes, motorcycles would come by. Then slowly came black open automobiles. And it goes into the president was driving down the street. The man beside the window narrowed his eyes as he looked through the rifle scope. Now he found the president's back. He held the weapon steadily and carefully squeezed the trigger. One shot, two shot, three shots. Within an hour, John Kennedy, 35th president of the United States, was dead. He had been shot by Lee Harvey Oswald, a man he had never seen and to whom he had done no harm. Now, this is a four-page booklet. They have a question. Do you remember whether Kennedy died of heart trouble, cancer, or after being shot? The publisher is Noble and Noble Publishers Incorporated. You might want to write to them, you people that write letters that listen. Noble and Noble Publishers Incorporated, 1 Dag Hammarskjöld Plaza, New York, New York, 10017. It said the situations and dialogue are fictional. The publication is based on historical fact. In other words, they're not sure that the man gave a little smile, and they're not sure that he narrowed his eyes, but they tell the children that Lee Harvey Oswald was the man who shot John Kennedy, a man he had never seen and to whom he had never done any harm. Now, that is pure propaganda in the year 1974, Carmel, California, school system. The same time that the children go to school and get that kind of information in their heads. I read an article this week from the San Francisco Chronicle, how satellites can beam secret messages. This is an article from the United Press. Satellites orbiting the Earth beam messages directly to television sets and viewers' home to brainwash people without them even knowing it by sending out so-called subliminal messages that are recorded only in viewers' subconscious. The technique can be used to mass hypnotize and influence politics of other countries. It is described as subliminal messages or excerpts in film that are flashed by light or sound so quickly and faintly they are received below the level of consciousness. An American satellite is already in orbit, transmitting educational and health programs in India and Latin America. The use of subliminal messages is banned in some Western nations, but not in the United States. The system can be abused to spread false news or indoctrinate unsuspecting audiences. Well, in addition to the subliminal of this type, the television this week showed the movie of Kennedy last Sunday at 5:30, The Days of Lightning. Maybe you've seen it. They rerun it. And in that movie, they show you John Kennedy playing with the children at the helicopter and going through the Cuban crisis and various events of his life, and then they tell you over very clearly that Lee Harvey Oswald shot John Kennedy. And this kind of myth, this propaganda, this pure lie, in spite of all the evidence, massive evidence and research of ballistics, of photographic evidence, fingerprints, palm prints, autopsies, ballistics, weapon ownership, weapon capability, there isn't any indication along the line, not one bit of evidence, the bullets that were shot from the rifle, not one bit of evidence that Lee Harvey Oswald shot John Kennedy. And this is 11 years later, but the mass media finds the anniversary of his death to keep throwing out information to you that is not, has no basis in fact. Now, there are a lot of people in the country, young people, giving lectures on the ballistics, the photographic evidence, the Zapruder movie of John Kennedy's head going backwards when he was shot, the fatal bullet, which defies the law of physics of Oswald's shot from behind. There are people in Boston that go on tour that show this movie, I know, and around the country in Carmel this week, the 11th anniversary of John Kennedy's death, Mike Cochran is showing at MPC University in the upper lounge at 1:30 Friday, the Zapruder films. And I'm sure that you have a team around the country. You can write to me if you want somebody to give a demonstration or show the movie or show the slides. If you hear this broadcast but have never seen the Zapruder film or seen the slides of photographic evidence on the death of John Kennedy, which also shows, there's some slides that show a gentleman picking up bullets on the sidewalk of the street and putting them in his pocket that the Warren Commission never used for their investigation. If you want those movies, or somebody to give a lecture or demonstration, or locally Mike Cochran can show you, write to me at KLRB, give me your name and address, and we can get somebody in your local communities to come visit you and talk about the assassination of John Kennedy. Congressman Henry Gonzalez is anxious to open up the Kennedy assassination. I have a letter here that he wrote to me. He wants your encouragement. He said he would share my research with him. He wants people to write to other members of Congress. In his letter, he says, you know, of course, that unless there's a large number of congressmen sincerely interested in this, our efforts will be in vain. So please be sure to communicate with your own congressman and with others with whom you might have some influence. Henry B. Gonzalez will go into the matter. He's from Texas, and he wants to open up the investigation of John Kennedy on the basis of the second gun and the evidence of the Robert Kennedy conspiracy and the Martin Luther King case opening up. There's all the more reason to push the John Kennedy. The evidence is available now. We don't even need what's locked in the National Archives to prove that there was a massive conspiracy, and that worst part was the massive cover-up, including the President of the United States and the Chief of the Supreme Court, Justice Earl Warren. So Earl Warren is dead. Many members of the Warren Commission are dead. So it's time now to move this along, and Congressman Gonzalez needs your support. You can write to him. You can write to other members of Congress. There's new members in there now. And keep this thing going, because it is going to unfold. There's no doubt about it. But it's a question of how soon. And as far as I'm concerned, the sooner the better. I brought in today some letters that I got from members of the Warren Commission, which I thought were interesting. Because when the Warren Commission met, I have the copies of the meetings, minutes of the meetings, of some of the meetings. Alan Dulles of the Warren Commission, who used to be head of the CIA, came to the meetings with a little book that I've talked about on the show maybe a few times before. And he said, gentlemen, I've got some extra copies of books, and I passed them out. I want you to read them. They're a little paperback book, he said. And he apologized for being a paperback book. But he said, it's a fascinating book. There's a pattern running through here, and I think you'll find it in this present case. It was a book about past assassinations, and he wanted to show how the Oswald case linked to the past. And this is important because related to the present, I just finished reading a good article by Popkin on the Ellsberg Watergate plumbers and Nixon's affair in the Ellsberg, smearing Ellsberg and comparing him to Alger Hiss. And the same method of operation has been used by the Central Intelligence Agency and was used by Alan Dulles then. They wanted to make Ellsberg be another Alger Hiss and link him to the Soviet Union or passing information to the Russian government as a spy. Well, in this case, they wanted to make Oswald look like all the other past assassins so that there'd be a pattern running through. And they fall back on history, like Richard Nixon says in the White House tapes, read my sixth crisis and go, let's do a matter like the Hiss case. We'll make the Ellsberg like the Hiss case. Well, the CIA at the time of the John Kennedy assassination was trying to make Oswald look like the past assassins. And John J. McCloy said at the meeting, he said, well, the Lincoln assassination was a plot. And Alan Dulles says, yes, but one man was so dominant it almost wasn't a plot. So he brought this paperback book, and in April he brought the book again. And he said, there's details of Lee Harvey Oswald that we should accumulate, and you bring them all to me, and I'll create the biography of Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, that was interesting, because he was an agent. Oswald was an agent of the CIA, and here was Alan Dulles, the former head of the CIA that John Kennedy had kicked out of the CIA, who was back on the Warren Commission, and he said, I want you to bring me the information of Lee Harvey Oswald, and he would link it to these past political assassinations and show a pattern that was running through. And Dulles says, I have another point and think it would be well to assign people to study these previous assassinations and look at this pattern, you know? He said, I'll get other books, but I have this book and I want you to read it and see how it relates to the past. Well, I wondered what book he was referring to. He brought a book, and several times at two different meetings, he referred to a book on past assassinations. And I didn't know back in 1969 that E. Howard Hunt was writing for Alan Dulles in 64. I didn't know that. He was writing The Cult of Intelligence, and E. Howard Hunt was a writer for the CIA, and he was also writing for Alan Dulles. And I didn't know it in those days, but I wrote a letter to every member of the Warren Commission to try and get the book, because I knew that the Lee Harvey Oswald in the Warren Report was a fictitious book. And when I read the Warren Commission hearings, the skills and the training and the know-how of Lee Harvey Oswald didn't jive with what the Warren Report said. So I wanted to see who was doing this fictional story and who was trying to link him to past assassins when this was a highly skilled agent of Navy intelligence. So I wrote to every member of the Warren Commission separately, and I said, I'd like to know what book you had at the first meeting of the Warren Commission or the second meeting, and I dated it, that Alan Dulles brought to you. May I have a copy of the book that he brought to you? And I got a letter. This is June 13th, 1969, and this is from John Cooper, member of the Warren Commission, who's now our ambassador in East Germany. He said, "Dear Miss Brussel, I've asked the archivist of the United States if he can supply me with the titles and names of the authors of the volumes you referred to in your letters of June 9th. When I receive a reply, I'll transmit it to you. The archivist has custody of all the material." Now, he didn't say I received a book or I don't have it. He had the archivist to tell me the names of volumes, and his letter was completely scrambled. It didn't answer. I have a copy of what I wrote to him, and it didn't make sense. He wrote me another letter. "I enclose a letter from the acting archivist to whom I referred your inquiry. I'm sorry he's not able to provide the information you seek." Now, all I wanted was the book that Alan Dulles brought to the Warren Commission, which they obviously weren't going to admit they had. I got a letter from the archivist, and he said, "We regret we're unable to locate the name of the author and the title of the book in the records of the commission." And so he denied that he didn't know what I was talking about. The archivist had no record of what each member of the commission had and acknowledged at their meetings. Then I got a letter from Charles Campbell, representing Richard Russell of the Warren Commission. "Dear Ms. Brussel, at the present time, Senator Russell is completely occupied with hearings by the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, of which he is chairman. Your correspondence will be brought to the senator's attention at the first opportunity, and I know you will hear from the senator directly as he feels he can give you information that will be helpful." He never told me. He sent good wishes. Sincerely, Mr. Campbell. Hale Boggs of Louisiana wrote, Dear Ms. Brussel, thank you for your letter. I wish I could be of some assistance in identifying the book you mentioned. However, I do not recall it, and I do not have it in my possession. Perhaps you should write to Mr. J. Lee Rankin, the general counsel for the Warren Commission, and he can be of help. He's working in New York City, and still is. He was working for Mayor Lindsay, general counsel for the city of New York. He didn't know what book I was talking about, and the minutes of the meeting showed Alan Dulles handing it around. I bet that this is a E. Howard Hunt book that was brought to the members of the Warren Commission so they would associate Oswald with all the past assassins, and none of them would recognize that book. Not one member of the Warren Commission acknowledged that they had received a book from Alan Dulles at two meetings, and he discussed it with them. They denied its existence and never gave the title or the author, which I thought was really funny, because whether they knew it was a fictitious book at the time or whether they smelled something about the tone of the letter being an investigator or what, I don't know. But I reached a blank wall from every member of the commission. Then I wrote a letter to Mr. Rankin in New York City, and he didn't answer me at all. He didn't acknowledge that he ever was there when the book was presented. Then I wrote to Gerald Ford, and this is June 9, 69. "Could you possibly provide me with the name of the book Alan Dulles brought to the meeting of the Warren Commission December 16, 1969? And I went into some problems with literature on past assassinations, and I never received an answer from Gerald Ford, and John J. McCloy never answered me either. So while they talked about this at the meeting, there was something very mysterious about it, and they denied its existence down the line. And it would be a collector's item. It would be interesting to pinpoint it. But I could say pretty accurately now that it was written probably by E. Howard Hunt, who was writing for Alan Dulles at the time. And they would collect all this evidence and smear Oswald E. Howard Hunt was brought in with Mr. Malloy to do a smear Ellsberg, a psychological profile on Ellsberg. He's the CIA psychological profile expert. And this is the same team that was smearing Lee Harvey Oswald just a few years earlier and taking every evidence that Oswald was different than the Warren Report said and just leaving it behind the bound volumes because Alan Dulles said at one of the meetings nobody will read it anyway. Then they published a volume which was written by Mr. Winokur, who sent the historians from Germany. He's from the Pentagon. And they wrote a piece of fiction which is also a collector's item named The Warren Report. And that still stands, and the children are still instructed that Lee Harvey Oswald killed John Kennedy. Well, it's only 11 years, and I'm not too discouraged about that. Getting away from the John Kennedy for a minute, and then I'll get back to it in an article in National Tatler this week. I did want to mention, last week on Dialogue Conspiracy, we talked about the article I did with Stephanie Caruana in Playgirl. The December issue is on the stands now. The name of the article is Howard Hughes Dead and Buried Off a Greek Island. I just wanted to read a few more quotations and references that were not included in the article but which were important. The theme of the article is that Howard Hughes was physically removed in 1957, that only five people take care of him, that nobody has seen Hughes except for a team they call him the Mormon Mafia. There's four or five men. His food is passed through slots and doors. The same meal is passed every evening, a goulash, a beef meal, one meal, the same thing. Every single night his bedding is handed out through the doors and messages are written on paper slipped under the door on the telephone. And I maintain that was removed to Greece where he died of old age and ill health. There were some quotations in one book. There's a book called The Hughes Nixon Loan. And in this book, the subject of that $205,000 that Howard Hughes loaned to Donald Nixon in Whittier, California, there was a quotation from that book that said, Howard Hughes picked out Nixon as a comer and made no secret about his willingness to financially support a man that he felt would ultimately be in the White House. And this was early in Nixon's career, that Howard Hughes was pushing Nixon because he knew he would ultimately be in the White House. But there was another quotation from the book, The Amazing Hughes, by Noah Dietrich, which I wanted to read on the air because it wasn't in the article. This has to do with 1953, when the Republican administration was in office, and the Secretary of the Air Force was a Harold Talbot. Harold Talbot's brother was on the board of TWA, and he wanted to replace him, his dead brother, on the board, and Howard Hughes wouldn't let Talbot do it. And a few years later, Talbot became the Secretary of Air Force under Eisenhower. And this Talbot came out to California, and Howard Hughes was getting large government contracts for aircraft in 53. And it was a time where Roy Ashe and the electronics experts, Ramo and Wooldridge, had branched off from Howard Hughes at Start Linden Industries, and government money was taken from the taxpayers' dollars to Hughes' empire and then siphoned off into these other branch corporations that were to mushroom into gigantic corporations. And the Secretary of the Air Force, Harold Talbot, came out to California to meet with Howard Hughes. And this is a quotation. He came out, he was with Noah Dietrich in the room and a Roger Lewis, who was the Assistant Secretary of the Air Force. And this was 1953, just 4 years before Hughes was to disappear completely. And this is what Talbot said to Hughes. He said, quotes, you personally have wrecked a great industrial establishment with gross mismanagement, Talbot exclaimed. I don't give a damn what happens to you, but I'm concerned for this country. The United States is wholly dependent on used aircraft for vital defense system. It would take at least a year to set up an alternative source of supply, and that would be a national tragedy. It was a terrible mistake entrusting the nation's security to an eccentric like you. Now, this is pretty strong. You see Eisenhower, a military man, a president, and his secretary from the Air Force is saying that the whole defense of the country is dependent upon Howard Hughes' defense system. Well, that was in 53, and in 57, a Hughes Medical Foundation had been set up that was to declare Howard Hughes mentally incompetent. The doctors wanted to declare him incompetent. The setup was down in Miami that was used as a tax deduction. And in the book, The Hughes-Nixon Loan by Nicholas North Broom, there's some more quotations. Noah Dietrich was the right-hand man to Hughes, and he's the one who also wrote that other book about Hughes and the experiences with the Air Force. And while a billionaire took over aerospace industry, Dietrich was his closest friend. And when the Hughes-Nixon loan was made, he was the voice of opposition. This was 1956, just a short time, half a year before Howard Hughes is to disappear. Dietrich explained that to Hughes that his government contract would openly invite problems if he gave $205,000 to the vice president's brother. But he was a company man, Dietrich was, and he finally went along with the deal that Hughes and other aides insisted upon. His advice was totally ignored, and Dietrich warned Howard Hughes, don't get into this giving money to the Nixons, don't link up with the Nixons. And he brought a lawsuit against Howard Hughes in 1959 because Noah Dietrich was cut off from Hughes. Hughes disappeared in 57, right after that foundation was started, and 6 months after the link to Donald Nixon and the money to the Nixon family. In 59, Noah Dietrich had a court case which was brought, this is in quotes, to a screeching halt, because it's interesting, all of the court cases against Howard Hughes are all dropped. Hughes never appears, and the case that just took place in Nevada this last week was thrown out of court, and the indictment was dropped about the merger of Hughes Air West and the manipulation of the stock, the owning and buying of Hughes Air West was thrown out of court. Well, every case that has been met with Howard Hughes, that they've approached Howard Hughes in the courts, he's either settled for money or the case is thrown out, and Hughes never appears. And in 1959, 2 years after I allege that Hughes disappeared, Dietrich had a case against Howard Hughes. He sued him and made a settlement of $600,000. But this is, I want to read part of this case. It was filed in Los Angeles, and I want to read part of this case because it's important. He alleged, Noah Dietrich alleged, at all times herein mentioned, defendant Howard Hughes was and still is the sole stockholder in defendant Hughes Tool Company, and said Howard Hughes has solely controlled and still solely controlled the corporate actions and activities of defendant Hughes Tool Company, and has dictated and still dictates the policies of the Hughes Company, and has been and is not independent of and is still identical with the mind and will of said Howard Hughes. But the Howard Hughes Corporation is a conduit for the transaction of his personal affairs and private business interests, and the alter ego instrumentality for the accomplishment of his individual purposes and for the manipulation of his personal financial interests under corporate guise and facade that Howard Hughes used and still uses the funds of the corporation to pay for his personal expenses. Now, he lists medical expenses, legal fees, and so forth, but I feel that the Hughes money has been used more importantly to go to important hospitals and universities that can be traced or possibly pinpointed to a lot of the electronic and computer and medical work that is going into mind control at the present time and behavior modification. Now, Dietrich swore under penalty of perjury that Hughes Tool was just a front and conduit for the great man to manipulate money. It's interesting, and he asked the court to lift the corporate veil in the name of justice. This was a case filed in Los Angeles in 1959. Dietrich lost all contact with Hughes, as did any other person outside of those four or five men that are with him now, with Howard Hughes, or the person impersonating Howard Hughes, that he asked that this veil be settled, he said, in the name of justice, that this was a front and a conduit to manipulate money. And the case was dismissed. And he said that, this is another important point, he said the Hughes Corporation, the Hughes Tool Company, is a corporate that all times herein mentioned, the corporation was and still is insolvent and indebted in the sum of several hundred million dollars and was and still unable to meet its obligations as they became due, and said corporation is and will be unable to satisfy a judgment against it in the instant case. Plaintiff alleges on information and belief that defendant Howard Hughes is solvent and able to satisfy a judgment against himself Therefore, an injustice will result if the corporate veil is not lifted and if defendant Howard Hughes is not personally liable for the debts and act of the said corporation. Now, this is the first time I had read that in 1957, Howard Hughes, who was supposed to be a billionaire, was in financial trouble and was indebted to several hundred million dollars. And the mismanagement of the Hughes empire and the story that he had $300 million or $400 million as against his not having money, this man's asking that the veil be lifted and that it's a conduit to manipulate money, is very serious and should be investigated for the implications that I'll be doing in other articles of where I think this money went. I don't think it was done for the entertainment of this man. You know he has no entertainment. He's living alone in a room, or the double is, and not seeing any person and not going out and not traveling or doing anything. So it can't be that this front and conduit is just for his entertainment. He's hardly living high. But I think it is a front and a conduit for something much more sinister. And that's why I think the Hughes article is important, and the evidence that comes out later will be important on, in the name of justice, as he called it in 59, just what exactly is happening to the Hughes empire. I think there's a big story out there, and I hope that the Playgirl thing just touches off some few sparks, and then it continues to take hold, and more articles that I come out with will pinpoint where I think the money is going. I hardly think it's for Hughes entertainment, and I know it isn't for our entertainment. I have just a few minutes left, about 3 minutes left, and I did want to go into three articles in National Tatler magazine. I'll briefly mention them, and you can back order them. Tatler is on the newsstands, a lot of newsstands and drugstores. You can pick it up. And if you get one copy, they always advertise their back copies, and they're pretty good about supplying them. August the 4th, 1974, was an article about two men that were offered $25,000 to fly an airplane out of Dallas, Texas, November 22nd, 1963, and these two men realized that this they could do a narcotics thing for $5,000, that this was important, and they realized after the assassination of John Kennedy that that's what the getaway plane was for. They turned down the offer. There were two pilots. The man who discovered these pilots, his name was William J. Cooper. National Tatler followed the August 4th article with one August 18th. Of the investigation of Detective William Cooper into Navy intelligence and the links of Navy intelligence to the John Kennedy assassination. And they are indeed tight links. Maybe I should detail this next week on Dialogue Conspiracy. And the investigator, he used to work at the FBI and the police department, William Cooper, had risked his life to locate the links of Navy intelligence in Louisiana and Dallas to the John Kennedy assassination, and he was about to testify at Jim Garrison's trial in New Orleans when the steering wheel came off his car and he and his wife and daughter were almost killed. So he couldn't appear in July 68 because he was in the hospital. Well, last week, just before this issue came out, October the 16th, which is 3 months later, he was doing more research and sent a letter to National Tatler with more information on the killing of John Kennedy. And this investigator, Joe Cooper, was shot in the face, lying in bed, and he was murdered. And the National Tatler, he was murdered with a bullet upwards through his cheek, right cheek, that lodged in his skull. His wife was in the other room in the kitchen. She came out, and the door was open to the hall. And this very fine investigator who had been supplying information for 10 years was murdered just a few weeks ago. His name is Joe Cooper, and maybe we should do a show about him. He did say in the August 18th issue, he said, "I feared for my life after the accident, but I lived," he said he lived a fairly straight life in America, but this is a quotation, "I don't care anymore. I love my country, and murdering the president is not the way to change it." And Detective William Cooper from Louisiana was murdered October the 16th. Issue of Tatler described it, so I guess he was murdered the first week in October, and they went to press. And these three issues tell the information that he was uncovering at the time. The first issue about the getaway plane involving links of New Orleans to Dallas, Texas. The second one was about the Navy intelligence ship outside of New Orleans, where a group of people were, seven people were aboard ship, planning the murder of John Kennedy. And the third article, which is sad, has to do with the murder of the investigator. And so the secret team keeps operating. Those assassinations are in the same category. I call them majors and minors. None of them are minor, and each one is equal in life and in death. But you not only kill the president or a candidate or a civil rights leader, but men like Mr. Cooper are murdered also. Well, that's it for Dialogue Conspiracy this week. We'll be on top of the news next week, and take care of yourselves until next week.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 10 years has been researching the facts behind political assassinations and conspiracies in this country. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KELRB-FM in Carmel, California.